Welcome to the Solid Verbal.
The Solid Verbal.
Come after me! I'm a man! I'm 40!
I've heard so many players say, well, I want to be happy. You want to be happy for a day? Eat a steak.
It's that woo woo!
And now, Dan and Ty.
Welcome back to the Solid Verbal, boys and girls. Ty Hildebrand here. Dan Rubenstein over there. SolidVerbal at gmail.com is our email address. Also, hit us up on Facebook at facebook.com/SolidVerbal. And look for us on Twitter at SolidVerbal. I am back. I am with my very good friend, my co-host of 5 years. His name is Dan Rubenstein. Sir, how are you?
I am really good, although it's still cold.
It is still very cold, actually.
What is going on?
It's that damn 8-foot horned frog statue. Have you seen this statue?
I have seen the statue.
Good hell.
It is as intimidating as a frog statue could potentially hope to be.
I'm not on the up and up with art, all right, and with sculptures and things of that ilk. How do you go about getting something like that commissioned? Like, what's the price? You can't go on Craigslist and say, hey,
no.
I want to build an 8-foot horned frog statue. Please respond, dot, dot, dot. How do you find someone to make that thing?
The internet.
God.
Here's what I'm just going to guess here. There's somebody that specializes in everything now.
But we horned frogs.
Horned frog. There is probably a frog sculptor living in Cincinnati, living in Tampa, living in Tacoma, and he is the go-to guy, maybe the go-to gal. If you're going to speak like a 1940s radio host.
Right.
And you go up there and he or she has like the tattoo book of different frog sculpting options and the price points that you are willing to accept. You're like, look, we want an 8-foot horned frog. We want it in this climate. We want it to be this color. We want it to be in this position. What can you give me in an 8-footer?
I love the narrative that there is a person out there who specializes in just frogs.
Ty.
You go in there and say, I want a sculpture of George Washington. No, I just do frogs. Frogs.
There's a patriotic, there's a forefathers sculptor. Probably in Alexandria.
There's more forefathers sculptors than there are frog sculptors.
That's why, well, then you're pretty smart to be a frog sculptor then.
You got the market.
You're getting all the business. So he's specializing in your standard toads and frogs, your horned toads, your horned frogs. Your poisonous South Americans,
your
Budweiser type, you know, the Budweiser, you know, some rich guy is going to spend his money terribly and get Budweiser frogs sculpted for his lawn. So there's a frog guy in Tacoma that just got paid.
Good Lord, that thing scared the hell out of me.
What does every school have in the student population? They have foreign exchange students.
Of course.
So you're going to have, you know, TCU, a terrific institution of higher learning. You're going to have people coming in from Europe, from Asia, South America, coming to Fort Worth to study. And as they're learning in English, learning in this new land, they're sort of acclimating to culture. And what do they have on their campus to teach them about America?
A giant mutant frog.
A giant sculpted mutant frog. And they're going to go back to their lands and explain how teaching is, how American kids are in school, what life is like in Texas. And I guess at every school, they just have 8-foot giant frog sculptures. That's like a thing in America. And that tickles me.
That is something else. That thing scared the hell out of me. Yeah.
It is ridiculous. Was there a ceremony, like a reveal of the statue? I would have gone.
It had to be some sort of reveal. Something like that.
A ribbon cutting?
I mean, to think of how much something like that costs. And I'm not anti-frog statue, mind you. I think it's great.
Statues are big business on college campuses. Controversial. Penn State. Tim Tebow statue.
Penn State would kill for a horned frog statue right now. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Anyway, this is the Solid Verbal where we talk college football. Dan Rubenstein is my co-host. He did a show with Celebrity Hot Tub in my absence.
I did.
Last week.
Where I misused my microphone.
You misused the microphone.
You can hear everything.
It's all right. Whatever. It's the off season. We're going to have Bruce Feldman on in just a little bit here. Had the Verballers out there send in questions to us via email, Twitter, and Facebook. And we got a bunch. I have a whole list of them here. Going to try and get through as many of them as humanly possible because you tell people that Bruce Feldman's coming on, they got questions.
They do. And spring football's going on all over the place. There are position battles. There are storylines. There is information to be gleaned from somebody who not only covers the sport full time like Bruce does, But is also traveling around, talking to coaches, seeing practices, and sort of making and coming to conclusions with his eyeballs. So we always like somebody on the scene. Nobody does it better than Bruce. So very excited to have him on.
We'll get to Bruce in just a second. Before we do, we just want to point out that spring is supposedly here.
Wow.
It snowed today, but it is here as of, I believe, March 20th, which was last week.
You know, it snowed today, but I still feel springy.
Even though it snowed, it melted quickly. The sun was trying to peek its way out. You can tell that spring is here. So we've got more offers for you. They come via Sherry's Berries. We discussed them a few months back. Send someone a giant dipped strawberry from Sherry's Berries, only $19.99. A 40% savings if you go to berries.com. That's berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right corner and type in solid again for 40% savings. We've had these berries before. I brought them up to the studio when they were sent to us just as a demo. These are ankle busters of berries, right? I mean,
they're like the size of tennis balls.
Right.
So pound for pound, you can't do better berry wise. It's, you eat them like an apple. They're so large. And mind you, the berries are so large, but then they're also coated in delicious.
They are.
Whether it's white, dark chocolate, nuts, whatever, sprinkles. Beyond spring being in the air, you know what's in the air during spring is love, Ty.
Love's in the air, yeah.
Love is in the air. Spring is a time of romance.
Love blossoming on the savannah.
What's the easiest way, if you're listening out there, buy them for yourself, buy them for loved ones, easiest way to get Sherry's Berries?
It's funny you should ask, Dan, because if you go to berries.com, berries.com, click on the microphone top right corner, type in solid, again, 40% savings, $19.99, check out Sherry's Berries. All right, well, on that note, let's get to our guest of honor.
Yes, what better
evening.
Way to bring him in?
Of course, Bruce Feldman from CBS Sports joining us now on the phone lines. Bruce, how are you?
I'm good. It is always exciting to be on with you guys. And the last time when we were in person, just the whole Jerry Palm Jeopardy thing, I thought it set the bar.
We have actually prepared a series of 90s hip-hop questions for you a little later on in the show.
Any R&B in there, or is it going to be all hip-hop?
No, it's R&B and hip-hop, yeah.
Okay.
We've got you covered here.
Okay.
All right. Well, first off, I know you've been traveling. Where have you been, and what is new on the countryside?
I was down in South Florida, spent a little time with James Coley, who used to be a Twitter sensation as far as football coaches go, but he's been a little tame. He's gone from Florida State to Miami, so it's good to catch up with him. And I spent a couple of days in Knoxville last week, and that was good. Very different vibe. You know, it's been interesting to see how Butch Jones, who wasn't their first choice, and Dave Hart, the athletic director, was telling me, well, they basically had four guys that they considered, and obviously one they never got very far with. That was John Gruden, and the other two were Mike Gundy and Charlie Strong. And Butch Jones came late on the scene in their mind, and, you know, people were skeptical. But I think just from here, talking to a lot of people both inside and around the program, they've really been wowed by some of the things he's done. Now, the downside is he wasn't left with much talent. I mean, they probably have the worst skill talent of anybody in the SEC. So it's going to, you know, for a proud program that's had to be patient the last few years with the Kiffin debacle and then it getting even worse under Dooley, you know, more patience is probably making people roll their eyes. But, you know, it's an interesting situation there.
What specifically has Butch Jones done to impress those within the program? And what is the best thing he can do in the short term and even just this spring during spring practice to really infuse the program, if they don't have talent, but with the confidence that the talent will be there and that he has hired the right people to get them back to where they want to be?
Well, I think for starters, what he's done is he's been accessible. You know, Derek Dooley was good on camera per se, but I think, you know, his dealing with people, he had a lot of turnover of assistants who came and went. He rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. He rubbed a lot of former players the wrong way. He basically shut them out. And, you know, Butch Jones is a real accessible guy. I mean, you had two legacy guys he followed in Kiffin, obviously famous, you know, coordinator dad, and Vince Dooley's son and Derek Dooley. And here's Butch Jones, who was a guy that basically broke in as a ball boy for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, that he talked his way into that job, and at one point had been a Division III tennis coach. So I think that kind of humility and that kind of, perspective on things has helped him. I think the other things that people have noticed, because he's had, you know, a lot of former volunteer players have come to his spring practices. They've seen real up-tempo. And you hear that a lot with a lot of new coaches and everything. But I just think he is very positive. The players look like they're having fun. I think if you want to see, you know, one good thing that you could definitely say about this group of players that he inherited is they bought in. And considering all the turnover that they've had, I mean, the offensive linemen, they have a great offensive tackle in Tiny Richardson. This is his third season. This is his third offensive line coach. You know, it's a lot of that, but the buy-in's been good. But as I said, you know, the quarterback play is really shaky. You know, they have no running backs of note, no receivers of note. There's a decent young receiver, Pig Howard, who I think will be a player. You know, they'll have to rely on him some. But they're going to struggle because, remember, they had the SEC's worst defense last year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, given all they had on offense and they still couldn't even make a bowl and got blown out by Vanderbilt, you know, they're going to be lucky, I think, to win six games next season. Also, keep in mind, they play five teams on the schedule that are probably going to be in the preseason top 10. I mean, they have to go to Autzen on top of all the other stuff they deal with. So, you know, you go to 6-6 this year, I think that people will feel probably optimistic that would be a decent first season. But then the things below the surface that I think are big are be competitive. You know, a lot of people looked at them and said they look like the team didn't look like, they look like they just were given up in games late. And, you know, I asked one of the players, I said, what was missing? Because you had 3-year starter, a quarterback, a lot of experience on the offensive line, and, you know, two freakish wide receivers. How could you not even go to a bowl game? And he said, I hate to say it, but it was lack of leadership. And I think, wow, you know, a lot of that had to do with in the locker room, but I think some of it had to do just at the top with Dooley, and it had just, the message just was not getting through. And, you know, another positive thing, the one question mark, the biggest question mark I think a lot of people had with Butch Jones was, you know, because he had won in the MAC, he'd won in the Big East, but, you know, how well could he recruit at this level? And a couple of weeks ago, he got a five-star running back, arguably one of the top 20 recruits in the country to commit. Everybody wanted Jalen Hurd. And I think that, and he's had a couple other big recruits, I think there's a buy-in level. And, you know, like I said, it's still going to be a shaky couple of years because they're going to struggle on offense. There's no way around it.
Right, and we'll go from a team returning very little to a team that you just mentioned, James Coley, taking the offensive coordinator job at Miami that returns a ton, especially on offense. So James Coley at Florida State, really no input on game day with play calling, goes to Miami, a team that returns pretty much everybody on offense. What is his immediate impact with the Hurricanes as he takes over on that side of the field?
I think it'll be more about, you know, kind of the style. I don't think he's, you know, he's radically different than the guy he's following, Jed Fish, who did a nice job with a, you know, a really, really young team.
Right.
I think from talking to Coley, you know, he inherits a good quarterback. You know, Stephen Morris is athletic, has a really powerful arm,
mm-hmm.
you know, has got to get more consistent, but I think there's a lot to work with. The offensive line is probably better than what Coley would have had this year at Florida State. He has a dynamic playmaker in Duke Johnson. I mean, if you saw Duke Johnson at the beginning of the year or the end of the year, you saw a guy who's probably one of the best players in college football. I mean, he is a home run hitter. Now, in the middle of the year, he was banged up and he wasn't the same guy. And I think, you know, he's gotten physically stronger. I think they need somebody to take some of the load off him. You know, he's a 190-pound guy. He's not a 220-pound guy. Offensively, I think they're going to be good. And I think if you're Coley, you know, he's a guy who I think has a chance to get noticed here because Miami should have one of the best offenses in the country. The issue with them is defensively, they were mediocre last season, and their defensive line, there is nobody up front where you look at and go, when Miami was great, they had great defensive linemen, and there's nobody up there. Anthony Ciccolo is a solid player, but there's nobody else really there that's anything special or difference makers on that defense. And I think it's probably a 9-win team. But beyond that, I think you know, almost every player, the best players that they had in the program were freshmen and sophomores. I think probably 2014 will be a year that I think they have a chance to be a legit, you know, top 15 team, because they should be that much deeper. But right now, I think they'll score a lot of points, and I think that they'll have a chance to play for the ACC title. I think they can play with anybody because of the firepower. It's just defensively, they're just, at best, they'll be average, I think.
All right, let's jump back to the state of Tennessee, because one of the questions that was sent into us by a number of different listeners pertains to James Franklin at Vanderbilt. I know this is a hot name. He's obviously made his mark in only a few short seasons. How many more seasons do you see him at Vandy? Is this where he wants to be long term, or do you think he ends up elsewhere at some point in the near future?
Man, how crazy is that we're talking about Vanderbilt at that point that so many people are asking? I mean, you know, that alone tells you what a job that guy and that staff have done there in 2 years. But, you know, for starters, Vanderbilt has really stepped up in its financial commitment to football there. James Franklin is getting paid well over $3 million. He's one of the highest paid coaches in the country. His staff is getting paid very well. They made a big commitment there. So the issues for them, the hurdles, is the history. They haven't been good, and now they are pretty good. I think the challenge is they have a great city to recruit to. They have obviously great academics, and those are two things. There's a little bit of buzz about them, and I think Franklin's done a really good job with that. Now it's you got to take it to the next level, and I think what that means is you got to beat the powerhouses in your conference, because what they've done a good job is they beat everybody else, and that'll get you 8 or 9 wins, and that's what it did. It got them in the top 25. I mean, they didn't beat any elite teams. Now, in fairness to them, they gave South Carolina a scare, and there was a real borderline questionable call that if that's a different way, maybe they could have beat them in the opener. You know, I think that the question long term is, you know, if he gets them to 10-3 next year or this year, where does he go from here? I mean, he's had chances to leave for bigger jobs. Vanderbilt has made a big-time financial commitment to him. You know, I can't tell you just how surprising it is to see, you know, where he ranks financially. Beyond that, I don't know what the situation where he's at. I'm curious what kind of job would be able to lure him away, you know, and what comes open. I don't know if there's – right now, I think James Franklin will be there for the next couple of years. And the other thing with him is he is – not going to be right for everybody. He is going to step on some toes. He's done that already, and I think that will probably turn some people off, so that probably cuts down the jobs. But you know, I'm curious to see if he can continue to elevate the program. I mean, he's taken it higher than anybody would have ever imagined other than James Franklin. So let's see what he does next. But I think he's going to be there for a while just because of the financial commitment they've made to him.
In the same vein of coaches that get people excited, what about hot new assistants that might be in line for bigger or better jobs come the fall, come maybe this time next year? Are there names out there that you're going to pay special attention to?
Well, the new part, I mean, Kirby Smart's name is going to come up all the time. He could have had the Auburn job, and he basically turned it down because, from what I'm told, there just was kind of a trapdoor quality to the way that deal was going to be set up or what Auburn was offering. You know, he's going to be there. I think Chad Morris, the offensive coordinator at Clemson, he's got Taj Boyd, who's a trigger man, who's going to put up big numbers in that system. And I think that he could have gotten the Texas Tech job, but everything broke right for Cliff Kingsbury in terms of Manziel had a great year. A&M had a great year. He became the hot guy, especially for that job. You know, I think Chad Morris, his system works. He's a guy I think will be somebody people will focus in on. I think he has a chance to be that guy this off season. You know, in terms of a couple other guys, one guy, Dan will probably hate hearing this, but I think Scott Frost's name has a chance to get hot too if they keep winning at Oregon. And, you know, the system is good. He's got more responsibility there. I think that people will see if they keep winning, and they should, you know, because they have Marcus Mariota there. He's got He's got his hands in the program pretty good. He's got a recognizable name. I think people could sell to him. The thing that I think would help him is if he was a little more visible media-wise, and that's, you know, kind of one of these things you'd probably say selfishly because you work in the media and you want people to be more out there. I think that would probably help his cause. But he's one on the West Coast, I think, that fits there. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, those are the guys, and granted, they're offensive guys, except for Kirby Strong, that I would say to keep in mind, you know, at this point.
All right. And one other one, an interesting question that Dan and I looked at on Twitter and said, wow, okay, this is interesting. If West Virginia doesn't finish 500 this season, Bruce, is Dana Holgorsen's job in any jeopardy?
Is this the Chris Brown question? Was this?
Yes. I don't want to incriminate. I'm just this was one that came into us. I'm just curious your thoughts.
You know, sub 500. I think that I don't think they would pull the plug on him. He has a good relationship with Oliver Luck, the AD. You know, they're going to struggle, I think, this year because they were abysmal on defense last year. Now I think they have to be a little better. I think they will. They have probably more experience running the defense with Keith Patterson now taking over. But on offense, I mean, not only did they lose Geno Smith, but they lost, you know, two great receivers and the whole interior of the offensive line. And I mean, I've been around the quarterbacks that are taking over now, you know, whether it's going to be Paul Millard or Ford Childress. My guess is it might be Paul because he's a very smart kid. He's got a lot more experience in the offense. And he can't run at all, and he's not the physical specimen that Ford Childress is. But I think the comfort level is there. You know, it's funny because Dana's strength on the team right now is really his running backs. And that'll be interesting to see what he and Shannon Dawson can do with that. They also, you know, had a bunch of changes on the offense. I mean, new offensive line coach because Bill Biedenbaugh went to Oklahoma. Jake Spavital, who's a great young quarterback coach, he ended up going to A&M. So, you know, I think there's a lot of turnover there, and that's a tough league. I mean, yeah, I know Kansas stinks, but Kansas should even be better because Charlie Weiss took like 65 junior college guys. So, you know, you look at it and you go, there's a very good chance that team could end up 5-7. I mean, as good as explosive as they were on offense, you know, they still struggled at the end of the year, and I think the leadership inside the locker room is changing because, you know, so much was Geno and Tavon, and that was the personality of the team. And now, you know, we'll see who takes over that. So, but I do think that, you know, I don't see Luck pulling the plug on Dana after, you know, 1 year if it turns out to be a really bad third year. I think he saw what the potential of this thing was, you know, in Holgorsen's first year when they blew up Clemson in a BCS bowl, and I think he sees, you know, there's going to be some growing pains for us going from a mediocre Big East to a much stronger, solider Big 12.
All right, let's go to a team in, I guess it's sort of the same football family in Texas A&M as West Virginia. They're replacing a ton of contributors, and by contributors, I mean some superstars. Offensive line, obviously losing left tackle and center. A lot in the front seven, a lot with offensive skill guys. Is there a specific position, group of positions that I guess the continuity of the Aggies' success is most closely tied to, especially given, you know, they're in the SEC, the context of the schedule ahead of them? Is there a specific area where there's urgency to figure out depth and where the talent is?
I actually think it might be at linebacker because, you know, they had a really nice season on defense considering, you know, they had limited players. Now, DeMontre Moore, nobody thought he was a big, big-time elite SEC defensive lineman at this point last year. And just from having been down there a bunch and spending a lot of time with their staff, he really learned how to play hard all the time. I mean, what he put up, you know, his performance at the combine, athleticism-wise, wasn't a fluke. He was never Kiki Mingo or those LSU guys. I mean, he is a decent athlete. He's a, you know, good, not great athlete who just played hard and they were, you know, he fit the scheme better. I mean, they had, you know, going 3-4-4-3. I think that was that helped him. You know, they're going to miss him. They're going to miss, you know, Jonathan Stewart in the second half of last year really became a much tougher, much more physical linebacker, and he's gone too. Sean Porter's a really athletic kid. Those are the guys we'll miss. You know, in Spencer Neely, you have a really solid, just a really smart kind of grinder guy who I think ends up, you look at what he did against Alabama, you look at what they did, you know, Barrett Jones and against that front, it was really probably the best performance Mark Snyder's defense had. And I think finding young linebackers to step up is a big question, because you're right. I mean, you got to be physical in the SEC, and we'll see if these new guys can handle it. I think as terrific as Luke Jokel was, you know, they slide Matthews over from one side to the other. He's terrific too. Cedric Oboye, who was started at guard, he'll go out to right tackle. I know from talking to the line coach there, they think he's, you know, an NFL kind of talent. So I think they're going to be fine on the O-line. They got some good transfer running backs coming in. Trey Carson, you know, is a big physical back from Oregon. Brandon Williams is more of a make you miss home run hitter guy from Oklahoma. Trey Williams is going to get better because he's a real elusive guy. So they got, you know, weapons for Manziel. Their receivers are really good and young and athletic. The challenge is, I think, ultimately with A&M is going to be expectations. The target is really on their back now. They're not sneaking up on anybody. And not to say that they did that throughout, but I just think that the expectations are so high that's going to be a test for someone. He had to replace, you know, three guys on a staff. I think, you know, the moves he makes are good, but, it's hard to, it's hard, you know, there's a reason why only one guy's ever won the Heisman twice. I mean, there's huge, huge, spotlight on Manziel, and he's embraced it. We'll see how that works out.
All right. One of the narratives really every offseason, but it obviously applies to this one, is not just replacing players, but it's figuring out what to do with the players you have coming back, either that have gotten better or have gotten worse. And an interesting situation has sort of grown in Seattle as Steve Sarkisian appears to have reached a bit of a crossroads, especially after Keith Price took, I think it'd be fair to say, a pretty significant step backwards with, yes, an up and down, mostly down offensive line. And obviously they lose Doug Nussmeier last year. I guess the question is now for the spring and for fall camp is, could we see more reps for the touted underclassmen as maybe a result of the mounting pressure that Sarkisian could be feeling?
I don't think we will. I mean, this is a really good question, and I'm glad it's, you know, we're talking about it on a national scope. Because it is interesting. You know, I like Sark. I think he's a really sharp guy. And there was some buzz around the program. And Keith Price, you know, he's a smart kid. He's athletic kid. He's not the biggest quarterback in the world. And I think he was so promising in 2011 and just really struggled. I mean, consistency was an issue the whole time from the start of the year to the end. And you're right, in terms of the offensive line, there was just something was off the whole time. Everybody likes the athleticism of the two quarterbacks behind him, right. Not to mention the guy they just brought in, Troy Williams, I think will be a really terrific quarterback. But I just think it's risky to pull the plug on a guy who's a three-year starter in terms of the leadership and how that affects your team, unless he's just really all over the place. I mean, the example I would use is actually go back to Texas A&M, you know, a couple of years ago, where you had, an athletic, talented guy behind the starter, they had to make the decision because the quarterback ended up just struggling as much as everybody liked them as a leader and thought as much of them. It just wasn't quite working out, and I don't know if that's the case, if that's the parallel I would make with things at Washington. I do think that it took Sark a while to upgrade the talent and the depth. And then last year they did lose some good players, and they're going to lose some good ones in the secondary again, you know. Right. And I think that if you watch them at the end of the year, they just, you know, they didn't look like they were all that close to turning it around and being a legitimate top 10 team. And I think it's, you know, there's a lot of attention on that because I think, you know, you talked about Holgorsen if he has a bad season. I mean, if Sark goes 6-6 or even 7-5, I think that there's going to be a lot of pressure because they are really paying that staff really well. You know, that's going to be a that's a job that a lot of people are going to be looking at.
A team with sort of the opposite problems of West Virginia and Miami, in that Florida State has a ton of talent all over the place on the defensive side of the ball, but are the team now that do lose a quarterback and have a, what appears to be a three or four way battle for that starting job, sort of highlighted by Clint Trickett, of course, offensive line coach's son, and Jameis Winston, the young five-star type who redshirted last season. So at this point, to what extent are you confident that Jimbo Fisher and his all-encompassing power on the offensive side of the ball is going to be able to now develop and pick the right guy to lead Florida State as they go through a bit of a transitionary time?
Yeah, it's tricky whenever you have one of these kinds of situations where you're likely to lose. You know, if you pick this guy, then that guy may transfer out, and you end up with a really depleted depth chart. Mm-hmm. I mean, if Jameis Winston and the other quarterback in the mix, Coker, is an Alabama kid. He's a big, you know, 6'5", 230-pound guy with pretty good feet and a really good arm. Jameis Winston's talents are fantastic. I mean, he's physically developed a lot since his Elite 11 days. You know, he's got everything you're looking for, and he's a great leader. I mean, in terms of the thing where he can get on and relate to anybody in that locker room. I mean, he is the guy in terms of that. Now, he's also got, you know, the baseball side of him. But I think the tricky part of this is you tab Jameis Winston now. You know, Coker probably leaves. Who knows where it leaves you with Trickett. I think if you make Trickett the guy, you probably keep all three quarterbacks there. Now, is that the best way to win and win an ACC again when you do have, you know, a lot of new faces on defense? I don't know. I mean, it's a weird dynamic there. I mean, Trickett's a tough kid. You can win with him. They have really good receivers around him, too. I just think you're looking at it and going, you know, Winston's a guy who looks like he could be a superstar quarterback. Do you just right now go, okay, we're riding him and we're gonna see how this works out and whatever happens, you know, to the rest of our depth chart, it happens. But that's what I think makes this really fascinating, to see how Jimbo handles this. And oh, by the way, you know, you're right about the control thing. Jimbo has six new assistants, and that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of juggling to deal with the new personalities and everything. And I think one of the challenges with Jimbo is a lot of these Nick Saban disciples, you know, as great a coach as Saban is, I think sometimes it gets them into a weird place where their personalities are different than Saban, how they run their organization. Sometimes they try to be too much like Saban and maybe get caught in a weird middle ground. And, you know, one of the interesting things you heard a lot at the Combine last month was when you saw all these Florida State guys, you know, everywhere, and people are, you know, gushing about them, is why did this team not do better than just win an ACC title? Why didn't, you know, they weren't anywhere near a national title? And you ask some of the players, and they just really shrug their shoulders and don't know. And, you know, I think that you have to look from the top on down of the head coach and how he handles it. And we'll see if Jimbo, you know, he's had to react to a lot of assistant coaches moving on for one reason or another. And we'll see if that maybe changes his style a little bit of how he runs the show.
All right. And just one Oregon question from me.
You get just one, Dan.
I get just one Oregon question. He did mention Scott Frost. But the storyline that appears to be the case with Oregon, there doesn't appear to be a ton of questions or a ton of things brought up. It sort of seems to be that the idea is Mark Helfrich is going to do a pretty good job of continuing Chip Kelly's legacy. But when you look at who Oregon does lose, which is some obviously offensive skill, some key, very experienced members of that defense, do you see an area of real concern that perhaps people aren't making a big enough deal about as Oregon looks to repopulate the depth chart?
Maybe in the linebacker area. I think those guys were good players. It just, you know, you're going to probably have a top five draft pick in Deion Jordan, but I think, and Chip Kelly, you know, having seen him a couple of weeks ago, one thing he kind of seemed to be really proud of is that they definitely upgraded the caliber athletes in the front seven on defense compared to where it was.
Right.
And I think a lot of those guys are younger guys. Now, that just doesn't mean they're not going to miss Deion Jordan, because they will. But I think with the linebackers, I mean, he had two guys who turned out to be real good leaders and playmakers, and those things aren't always easy to replace. But, you know, I think that's being nitpicky. I mean, I like the young secondary, how they kind of stepped up. And I think they're going to be terrific on offense, because I think we're just going to see the quarterback get that much better. And they're deeper at running back, which is scary to say this, but I feel like they're going to be deeper at running back than they've ever been, you know, and have so many different kinds of dimensions now to it. And, you know, we'll see how much, you know, if they become a little more of a passing team, you know, because they've done that when people have forced them, you know, forced their hand, that they've shown they can be really dangerous at that. But, you know, I think they're going to be fine. I mean, not only is Helfrich, I mean, yeah, basically the whole group is there. I mean, he lost, you know, Jerry Azzinaro is a really good D-line coach, but that was it, you know. So I just think that the machine is going to keep rolling on. And about the only thing that I would see that could really rattle Oregon, and it's crazy that this thing is still dragging on, is who knows what's going on with the NCAA case. But beyond that, you know, I think under Helfrich, they're going to be strong.
We haven't talked a whole lot about this on the show, but scale of 1 to 100, 1 being the least surprise, 100 being the most surprise. How surprised were you about Gunnar Kiel? Be honest.
I'll say 5.
There you go. That feels about right. I mean, Gunnar Kiel, the irony is that when he came out of high school, some services out there said that decision-making was one of his strengths. Now, obviously, he's made several decisions, and he's going to make another, but do you have any sense for where he may end up once all this is said and done?
My guess is he'll end up somewhere in the MAC, and he'll just end up at a place where somebody, he'll not promise him the job, but, you know, the scariest thing about Gunnar Kiel, and Notre Dame fans hated to hear this a year ago at this time, was the willingness to compete and step into it. I mean, he gave some people, like, some second thoughts about him when they saw him out at the Elite 11, where he's around a lot of other quarterbacks, and how he responded to that. I mean, of all the things there, I think that's one of the more interesting barometers for a quarterback, is how they embrace competition in that setting. And it was noteworthy to me that he left when he left, as opposed to, hey, I'm going to go, you know, because even if he left after spring practice, it's not like he's going to be eligible in 2013 one way or the other to play somewhere. So why not, you know, go through, try to get better in 15 practices? And he just, that's not what he wants, so... You know, that's his prerogative, and we'll see. You know, guys mature at different times. Maybe he'll just, in a better system for him, or a more comfortable system, he'll mature over time, and it'll work out.
All right. Well, that brings us to the quiz. We got to get to this quiz. So last time we got a lot of attention for the Wu-Tang Clan question. So I want to tailor the questions more.
I have questions too, Tom.
You have questions.
You should have gotten good attention for Jerry Palm's answering and what he knew and what the areas where I thought he was a little bit missing.
Give me again the sense for what your wheelhouse is and isn't.
My wheelhouse is probably more R&B than hip hop.
Perfect.
But that's where I would say.
All right. Well, let's start off with an easy one here. All right. In the 90s, when Boyz II Men rose to fame.
Why do you guys keep going to Boyz II Men? I feel like that was your thing. Is that big in, like, well, they're Philly guys, so I guess.
They're Philly guys.
They are Philly guys.
In the 90s, when Boyz II Men rose to fame, how many members did it feature?
Four
members. That is
correct.
That is correct.
Bruce, are you familiar with the song This Is How We Do It by Montel Jordan?
Yes, I am. In fact, I was out at a bar this weekend where some guy played it, but he did it in, like, a acoustic kind of grunge version.
All right, I've got a three-part question based solely on this song. Where is the party?
That's a good question. Hang on.
By the way, I should note that I also have Montel Jordan on my list of questions. So
I know how tall Montel Jordan is. Does that help?
I'm going to ask for 5 seconds here.
I know. Sorry. East side, west side, west side.
Party's here on the west side. That's
right.
True.
West side, yeah.
Part two. Why does Montel Jordan hit the shore?
Let's see. I don't know. You got to tell me.
Hit the shore because I'm faded. That's the answer to faded. All right. When do you got to get your groove on?
To get paid.
Before you go get paid. That's paid, correct. Yeah. I'll take that.
Okay.
All right.
In the year 2000, R&B artist Aaliyah contributed the track Try Again to her first feature film. What was the name of that movie?
Oh, what was mine?
It's the pick yourself up and try again. Is that what it is, Ty?
Dust yourself off and try. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, or dust yourself off and try again. Right. Yeah. Oh, that's a good question.
That is a good question. Romeo Must Die.
Ooh, there it is.
Wow.
Bruce Feldman.
I remember where I was when I found out Aaliyah died. I was at the Meadowlands for a game, one of those kickoff classic games.
So the instructions are to wave your hands from here to there, but only if you're an OG Mac or this.
Wannabe player.
Correct.
All right. We'll close it out with this. I've got one here. Which well-known recording executive signed Usher to his first recording contract at age 13?
I don't know this.
If I had to guess, I would guess Clive Davis.
Ooh.
Tommy Mottola?
The answer is L.A. Reid.
It's one of those three, the Holy Triumvirate.
Not bad, though. Not bad. Bruce Feldman from CBS Sports. Check out his fine work, Bruce. All right, so are there plans now in the near future to go elsewhere? I know it's going to be a busy spring for you.
Yeah, I'm going to hit a bunch of different places. I got at some point I'm going to go to Michigan and Michigan State, and I think Notre Dame. I'm going to go up to the Oregon schools and probably Washington.
Nice.
And this one trip, I had a Texas swing. The problem is one of the places I definitely want to go to is Texas Tech, and I forgot what a pain in the ass it is to get to it.
Right.
Just in terms of, so I think I'm breaking it up into separate trips. So I'm going to go to Texas A&M for a couple of days, just stop into Baylor, even though they're done with spring, just to see Art Briles, and then go to Lubbock. So I think that's it. I mean, UCLA starts in a week, so I'll go out and see them. And I've seen USC once, so I'll probably try to see them again. But that is it for now. I had wanted to go to see the three Carolina schools and wanted to go see LSU, but it's bunched in, and I committed to a bunch of TV stuff out here. So
the good life.
Sure, I'm not complaining. It's not like I'm doing brain surgery or doing real work. So
there you go. All right.
Anybody who complains about covering sports for a living is in the wrong business.
That is true.
Bruce Feldman, CBS Sports, thanks as always for hopping on, and enjoy your spring. We'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
All right. Again, his name, Bruce Feldman.
Yes.
Find him over on CBS Sports. He's traveling around this spring trying to share his insight with you, the viewing, the reading, the listening public. Anything strike you?
A, knowledge bombs. Can you play the music? God, I really do like that song a lot.
It's great.
We composed that song.
We did.
B, a lot of teams with very similar problems. Offense not as much an issue in West Virginia. Obviously, the quarterback situation and skill position. It seems like that's an offense, especially given how quickly Dana Holgorsen has installed it everywhere he's been. Installed it very quickly at Oklahoma State. Installed it pretty quickly at West Virginia. Where you don't want to immediately say plug and play like other offenses around the country. But there is an assumption that he has recruited to that system pretty well, and that they'll pretty quickly get on a roll offensively. But the defense is a huge question, and it needs to get better quickly. I agree with Bruce that I don't think Dana Holgorsen is out sub 500, but that seat becomes scorching because of the investment in the Big 12 switcheroo, the investment in the program as a whole, and going after Dana Holgorsen. And that's a program 2 years removed from a BCS win. Expectations are raised.
Yeah.
West Virginia is now a perennial top 25 program type team. So that, I think, is interesting. The Washington scenario interests me. There's all sorts of storylines that I'm curious about. But what is your opinion of the Florida State situation? Because I thought he brought up a number of good points where it's a very calculated risk. You have to figure out the cost benefit of who you name, not just at Florida State, but anywhere.
Yeah.
Depending on a quarterback's year in a system.
Yeah, and let me also bring up that even though Jimbo Fisher has been really successful out on the recruiting trail, among the many Florida State fans that listen to our show, the verdict is kind of out on Jimbo. Some folks are kind of disenchanted with him because the team's been great. The team's won double-digit games, but has not competed for a national championship. And it's that extra gear, that extra level that many Florida State fans hoped for when Fisher was named coach.
Yeah, a number of interesting battles all over the place. We didn't get to some of the questions we wanted to ask. Wisconsin is another situation where incoming coach Gary Anderson has no real bias. He recruited a JC transfer who came, who was at South Carolina briefly, Tanner McAvoy, looked at a couple of places, looked at Oregon, looked at West Virginia, eventually ended up at Wisconsin. So sort of navigating what the implications are of who you choose. With the Florida State situation, Clint Trickett obviously showed some in relief of E.J. Manuel these past couple of seasons, but
I don't think you can go with Clint Trickett.
You don't, because
I feel like, and maybe this is unfair to Clint Trickett, I don't know.
Right.
You can get a decent sense for what his ceiling is, and I'm not all that impressed with it. So if you've got another guy, a dynamic athlete, a dynamic quarterback that you can bring in who isn't Clint Trickett, I think it's worth looking at. Just because this is a program that needs to win and needs to win consistently year in and year out.
How often do you have, and obviously there are flameouts all the time, but in the case of Jameis Winston, I want to say he'll be a redshirt freshman this year.
Right.
How often do you have that guy where you don't even know what his ceiling is?
Yeah, well, that's just
it. Jameis Winston is, and I saw him briefly at a camp in my very limited time out actually seeing this. He's incredible. He was thin. I'm sure he's put on some weight being in a college weight program and, you know, going to the just eating.
Sure.
But when you don't really have a sense for his ceiling, he is a top baseball prospect, yet you'll probably lose, like Bruce said, other prospects competing. But sometimes it feels like rolling the dice on that type of player. When Florida State has national championship aspirations, you're not talking about a school like a tier down. You're not talking about South Carolina. You're not talking about Texas. You're talking about a team that has national championship aspirations now.
Sure. They're built to win now. Winner. They're built to win now. And Clint Trickett, again, redshirt junior, has thrown for nearly 1,000 yards, but he's in his fourth year.
Right.
I just feel like you have a better sense for Trickett's ceiling. You bring in a guy like Winston, even Coker, guys who are more athletic.
Right.
I don't know. I feel like that gives you a little bit more upside.
No, I agree. I agree with everything you said. It could be argued that, though, looking back on Florida State this past season, where they tripped up first, obviously, with NC State and then with Florida, that it wasn't the fault necessarily of E.J. Manuel, just because it wasn't a talent thing with E.J. Manuel, is what I'm saying.
It wasn't.
It appears that even throughout the season, Florida State just did not play as well on the road, did not play as well in their biggest games other than Clemson, which was a great performance. It appeared that players were not necessarily always in the best position to win, not always the most motivated. And as Bruce mentioned, that it is Jimbo Fisher's team in every sense of the word. And I think a lot of people like him, as you mentioned, because of his ability to recruit. He seems to be a very likable human.
Yeah.
But the ability to delegate and trust a staff is one that I think that he's still figuring out and sort of feeling his way through. And that, I think, is going to be huge moving forward with whoever he goes with, which is why I asked Bruce how confident he was in his ability to essentially select and develop, even with all the talent around there. Yeah. That's what I'm still most concerned about.
Well, again, it's an interesting story to follow. I'm interested in it from the standpoint of Jimbo Fisher and some of the malaise that we've sensed anyway from Florida State faithful regarding their coach.
Jake Ryan out for the year. Kind
Jake
of awful.
Jake Ryan out for the year. I saw
Michigan's
that.
Leading tackler.
Yeah, that's not good. Not good. I guess it's the off season, Dan. We're going to be getting into spring football mode here shortly as spring practices ramp up, as spring games begin to find their way onto television over the next couple weeks. We'll be right here to talk more and more about that as best we can, shed some insight with the best guests from around the country. I should point out before we go.
Yes.
Your Oregon Ducks in the Sweet 16. How's that feel? How far do you have them going?
When you're an alumnus of an elite athletic institution.
Of course.
You come to expect these types of things. I have them. I actually did in my bracket have them penciled into the Sweet 16.
If you're an alumnus, you almost have to do that, right?
Yes. But actually, I did feel good about Oregon. Not that I know a ton about college basketball, but automatically assuming Oklahoma State because they had a good point guard and automatically assuming St. Louis. The level of competition never really impressed me with St. Louis. I know a lot of people like to make a big deal of these smaller leagues in college basketball. But as we've seen, Big East has done pretty well. Big Ten has done pretty well. So, Oregon's a good team. I didn't watch a ton of them this year, but when I did see them, they're a well-coached team. They're older. They've got a bunch of seniors. They got good contributions from their younger players. So I blindly, with my fandom, went with them as a Sweet 16 team. But I think the run is over, come Louisville. But it's a good run.
All right. Well, big thanks again to Bruce Feldman from CBS Sports for hopping on with us here.
Yes.
Do stay tuned to our Twitter and Facebook accounts where we post things from time to time. Good luck if you're still alive in our bracket pool. We'll talk to you again in a few days. In the meantime, for that guy over there, Dan Rubenstein, for myself, Ty, here in Eastern PA, thanks again for listening. Catch you all soon. By all means, stay solid.
Peace.